I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to the fifth newly recorded episode of Free Forum in 2017. And I'm going to be joined today by Rob Johnson. He's the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and director of the Project on Global Finance at the Roosevelt Institute. After hosting and producing this show weekly for 17 years, I stepped away from recording new live interviews in 2014. And since then, I've dug into the archives to stream one of the best of my earlier interviews each week on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And podcasts of all the years of shows are available to listen to anytime, anywhere on iTunes and at my site, terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. But following the election of Donald Trump, I cannot resist exploring our path forward in confronting him and his administration. So thus these new live interviews. On Freeform, we've always explored the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work, based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. First off today, I want to offer you a few websites for information on how to actively participate in the resistance to Trump and the movement toward the healthy, progressive future we so desperately need. Email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com, temcnally at mac.com, to get these websites and more. Indivisibleguide.com. One word, indivisible guide. OurRevolution.com, which is the organization founded by the remnants of the Bernie Sanders campaign. CourageCampaign.org, which is a great organization in the state of California. MoveOn.org, which had for most of its life been mostly online, has now realized that it's linking itself much more closely to grassroots action on the ground as well. And finally, fivecalls.org, five calls, and that tells you calls that are relevant and pertinent to be made that day or that week. And townhallproject.com, which tells you when your representatives are going to be holding town halls in your area so that you can show up there and let them know what their constituents really think and feel. Preparing for today's interview, I came across this quote. I think I found it on the website of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and I think it's a good place to start. Quote, "When the economic system breaks, it spares no one. But such a crisis can provide an opportunity to work together to create real, lasting change. And this is one of those times." This is right after the crash of 2008-2009. "This is one of those times, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to transform economics as we know it." But we didn't transform economics. Not only that, we didn't respond in any meaningful way to most who were hurt in the crash. Many of these people had felt left behind and hurt long before the crash, and enough of them turned out at the polls in the Rust Belt last fall to elect Donald Trump. Rob Johnson has an interesting history. He's been a player among the elites, chief economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee, and a director at Soros Fund Management, for example. Yet, I find him a plain-speaking and passionate critic of an economic, financial, and political system that leaves too many behind. He's been a guest on this show a few times since we first met in 2011, and I'm eager to hear what he has to say about events of the last year, and even more, the underlying systemic issues and trends that brought us here, as well as how we can move forward. Robert Johnson serves as director of the Project on Global Finance at the Roosevelt Institute. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist. He served as chief economist, as I said, of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee. He was an executive producer of the Oscar-winning documentary Taxi to the Dark Side. Johnson was a management director at Soros Fund Management and is now executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, funded by Soros, to encourage and support a rethinking of the fundamentals of economics so that they take into account the role of human behavior, including politics. Welcome again, Rob Johnson, to Free Forum.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. As you know, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas. So I mentioned your roles at Soros and the Senate Banking Committee. Could you talk a bit about your path to the work you're doing today and feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision?
Sure. Well, I think that probably the context that sets the stage for all of this is I grew up in the Detroit metropolitan area.
Ah.
And what I would say about that, why that is important, is because everybody now talks about fake news and post-factual democracy. When I was growing up in Detroit, and watched Detroit go through the 67 riots and some labor and management turmoil, and this was during the Vietnam War protests, and then the deindustrialization of Detroit, almost everything I heard suggested that Detroit was a problem because of corrupt black, meaning African-American, administration of the city, and that the entrepreneurs had lost their mojo. And then I went on to college, MIT, and did a PhD at Princeton, and I learned all of this equilibrium economics, and it was almost like what you might call, let's presume a happy ending. And my view was that at some level, economics and the story that was told about Detroit were not fake news. They were a fake reality. And what I mean by that is that Detroit was not analyzed for what actually happened. A narrative was constructed about Detroit that, what you might say, created the feeling that if you believed in the American dream, the violence and the velocity of the collapse of Detroit was not going to be applicable to your future. There was no reason to fear. You could go back to believing in the American dream. It was a special case.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously now, when we look at globalization and the many, many different cities in America who are subject to the vicissitudes of global commerce, and we look at the fact that demographics have changed, and the multi-ethnic, multi-racial, multicultural environment, which was so characteristic of Detroit, is now the characteristic of all of our cities. And what I would argue is that Detroit, rather than being a special case, is actually what you might call like a canary in the coal mine.
Right.
It exposed the kind of fault lines where economic dysfunction can exacerbate racial animosity and lead to a political spiral in dysfunction that creates a horrid outcome. And I hope every city in America, and for that matter around the world, can avoid those outcomes, but they would benefit a great deal by learning the lessons of Detroit. So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying that's how I got off course from what you might call believing in the package, and then working in the legislature or working in the hedge fund industry and investment industry, ideological constructs matter very little. Getting the answers right when you have responsibility, whether it's to make money or create policy, are much more important. So I found orthodox economics to be of some but limited value in my pursuit of professional objectives in those two places.
And that was as true for you in the Senate Banking Committee, that thing about the economic ideology not being important.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is what you're saying is not important in getting the right answers, although I might imagine important in how you communicate those answers and how you get those answers to translate into policy.
Well, that's the dilemma, which is you have certain narratives and certain mythological structures. I'm reminded of Leonard Cohen's first book entitled Let Us Compare Our Mythologies. And you're looking at things like when I was there, the savings and loan crisis, the 87 stock market crash, accompanied by all of the deregulation of finance, what we now call financialization, and the assertions from many, many scholars that markets are efficient, markets are rational, and the only thing that government regulation or restrictions does is create inefficiencies. And so there were tremendous contradictions between what I thought I saw happening in these various crises and with the predictions from the baseline orthodox economics. But you're right, when I had to explain things, I often had to appeal to the what you might call the language and the metaphors and
even the mythologies
the within the profession.
Yeah,
it's like anthropological or tribal studies. You have to understand what the tribe will react to and resonate with. And because I'd been trained in that set of that language, if you want to call it that, then I could converse with people in that realm.
Now, you were at the banking committee before you were in the hedge fund world.
That's correct.
What was that transition like?
From the banking committee? To
yeah, from working in D.C. to working in Wall Street.
Yes.
As I say,
yes.
These are the two centers of lots of things. But mm-hmm. for someone making the move from one to the other, what was that like?
Well, I think there were a number of factors. At the time, my second child had just been born. And so I was thinking about my personal finances as Ronald Reagan was compressing the pensions and benefits of working on Capitol Hill. Second thing that I think mattered was my boss at the second job that I had on Capitol Hill was William Proxmire, and he was retiring. And I didn't really relish working for other people. But Proxmire had a very unique staff and a lot of integrity and had a very strong intellect. So how would I say, my job wasn't staying the same there. But the contrast, it was actually quite marked. And I remember Tom Ricks, who was a reporter at the time at the Wall Street Journal. He's now, I believe, at the Washington Post. And he came up and said, "How do you feel?" And I said, "You're going to be surprised to hear me say this, but by being involved in financial analysis and portfolio management, I feel a certain sense of clarity as to what my purpose is." What I meant by that is there was a certain toxicity associated with being a senior staff member on a Senate committee in finance and banking, where you knew that a lobbyist in one lunch with a couple of fundraisers could undo 6 months of your work. And when you existed as an aide and a staff member in closed door, what they call caucuses among the members, a lot of what was going on, as Bismarck would say, you should never see law, sausage or legislation made. And as a young man in my mid-20s, I got a great deal of exposure
to sausage, yes,
as to how things really go down. So I didn't feel like at the time when I went to finance that the situation was, how do you say, fraught with moral dilemmas and so forth. And I thought the people I worked with, particularly there at Bankers Trust at the outset, were a very ethical and sharp and crisp bunch. And things in my group, you know, continued in that way as long as I worked at Bankers Trust.
And my guess is that in D.C., you keep score in all sorts of ways, and probably three or four scores going at the same time. In the hedge fund, it gets much clearer.
Yeah, there's a clarity of outcomes because without making it too precise, you have a profit and loss report every day or every Friday that's kind of tells you where you're at.
Yeah. You're not thinking about how is this going to play in this constituency and what's it going to do 2 years from now and so on.
Yeah.
Now, you worked for Soros, and then how did the initiation of the Institute for New Economic Thinking happen? And
sure.
What was your role and what was Soros's?
Okay, well, many years after he and I had been colleagues at his firm, you know, I had been employed by a partnership that he set up, we had stayed in touch, and I had done a lot of work in film and music and political philanthropy, various different activist-like endeavors. And what basically happened was the TARP legislation was being proposed in the crisis at the time of Lehman Brothers. And I went down, like many of the alumni of the Senate Banking Committee, many of the people who were my colleagues at the time who stayed are now senior people, like Marty Gruenberg, who runs the FDIC, a man named Dave Smith, who was a right-hand man to Barney Frank, a lot of Chris Dodd's staff. And I knew all these people, but I went down and stayed in Washington, stayed at a friend named Rob Duggar's house, and he had worked on both House and Senate Banking Committee. And we basically volunteered as staff. But I kept in touch with George because you probably recall that TARP legislation was this page and a half sent by Secretary Paulson, which was essentially give us the money with no conditions.
Right. I remember that very clearly.
That was the first draft. And,
yeah.
And the legislators, Chris Dodd, Barney Frank, and their colleagues, were very uncomfortable with that. They thought that was, you know, that wasn't going to go down well with the American public, nor should it. And so when I started talking with George, he said to me, "You know, when I was young, there was a very bad banking crisis in 1931 in Austria and Germany. And when that unfolded, almost all sense of order and legitimacy and rules and what you might call confidence in any kind of system disintegrated. I think at this juncture, there's actually a book by the scholar at Princeton, Harold James, called The Creation and Destruction of Value. And what he really meant was not value like money, but values around which you organize a society in the 1930s. And then he drew the parallel to the 2008 crisis. It's a great book. I encourage people to read it. But it's this kind of sense, I guess what I would call a void, where the orthodoxy, if you go back, you roll the clock back to 2008 or 9, and what's going on? All kinds of people with PhDs in the natural science are now designing derivatives. All the top managements at these big mega banks and everybody else are acting like everything's under control. It's like a docking station for a rocket in Mars or something. Like they have got this under control. And then, obviously, it was unmasked that not only did they not have it under control, but they darn near took the whole world economy down and necessitated hundreds of billions of dollars of bailouts. And it unmasked what you might call the false certainty or false confidence of the financial economics, architecture, and the practices of very much what you might call the highest paid members of our society. I remember John Kenneth Galbraith wrote a wonderful book around the 87 stock market crash time called A Short History of Financial Euphoria. And in that book, he makes the statement that once you've all bought in, that the best and the brightest and the most disciplined and far-sighted are financiers, and that's why they get paid so much. When that system breaks down, it really scares society. So it's in that spirit, coming back to your question, Soros and I talked about me then touring around the world and talking to leading economists about what was wrong with economics. And then in September of 2009, we convened 30 of the world's leading economists and had about a two-and-a-half-day brainstorm. And George and I had lunch the following day, and he said, boy, I think this situation's much worse than I even imagined. We got to do this. And we set forth together. He would support the funding, and I would build an organization. And we held a first major conference at Cambridge University in England in 2010, April. And then we've been carrying on ever since.
Okay, and let me read this quote. The Institute for New Economic Thinking's mission is to nurture a global community of next-generation economic leaders to provoke new economic thinking and to inspire the economics profession to engage the challenges of the 21st century. And you said you had that first conference in, is that 2009?
2010, 2000. April was the first conference.
So we're 7 years in. How's it going?
Well, I would guess, number one, we have a young scholars initiative that, for instance, last year in Budapest, Hungary, had 550 people from all over the world congregate for 3-4 days. There's about 6,000 people that are active on that mailing list and 1,500 people that are engaged in study groups. So I think we're in the, in the process of building that next generation. It's a long game. This is a 20-year-plus game to bring that together.
That's right. In other words, you didn't label it new economic policy, which would be one or two things. It's new economic thinking. That's a paradigm. That's a paradigm shift.
Well, you're going to the roots, the underpinnings, what I'll call the tribal customs, the assumptions, the suppositions, things that are not scientifically derived, but things that are agreed to by the members of the profession. And you're questioning those things. You're kind of trying to shake it up in the aftermath of things not working so well in the realm, in this case, of finance. But subsequent to that time, I've actually had a change of view, which makes the Institute more important than ever, which is the crisis of 2008 was not a crisis in finance, ultimately. In a much bigger context, it was a crisis in the legitimacy of governance. We didn't prevent what happened in finance, and we didn't really repair things significantly. You know, neither did a lot of people go to jail, or the structure of the financial markets changed profoundly. And so it feels like on both left and right, people became more suspicious of governance, thought of governance as kind of a what you might call a crony insurance policy for the rich and the powerful. Not governance is not the place where social needs are met. And with the role of money in politics in the United States in particular, but even the power of banks in Europe and so forth, more and more people have become skeptical about the role of government. And I've often said you can have a narrow mandate for governance or a broad mandate. That's a philosophical argument. But no matter what mandate you choose, you should have a very strong, well-prepared, well-trained, well-paid civil service to execute it. And what I think we've seen is in the corrosion of trust in public authority, we've seen an attempt by those who would like a narrower mandate to actually weaken the civil service, which has the effect of discrediting the civil service because their actions are not always up to par or, you know, best standards as you like to see. And that creates a self-fulfilling prophecy which validates dismantling government. And I think we're in a dreadful place now where things are quite unrepresentative. Just take globalization and trade agreements as a quick example. Everybody in the economics profession talks about free trade and benefits of free trade. It's almost like a mantra. But the idea that you can make everybody better off and no one worse off depends upon being able to make transfer payments out of those gains from trade to take care of those people. Now, I'll ask you a question. If you and I had breakfast every morning since 1990, and I said to you, I'm going to put $1,000 on the table in a bet against you, I say there will not be a significant trade adjustment bill passed in the United States in the next 365 days. But if I'm wrong, you can have my $1,000. And if I'm right, I get your $1,000. I don't think there's one day in the United States of America that a major economist would have put $1,000 on the table. In other words, nobody believes all those compensation things are ever going to happen. So why do they talk about free trade as though it's coupled with these transfer payments when, in fact, an expert, a bona fide expert who looks at American political economy knows darn well you're going to get the trade agreements, but you aren't going to get the things that soften the blow and the transitional adjustment assistance.
And just to ask you a question right into that one, Rob, mm-hmm. when the trade agreements are signed, whether it be, you know, NAFTA or any of the other ones, there is talk of transfer payments to those who are going to be hurt by it. There is, in other words, what you're saying is they're not in the original bill. There's sort of talk that eventually we'll do that or soon we'll do that, and then that just never happens. Is that the way it sort of plays out?
I think there's a little bit of that, but there's also this kind of legitimation of free trade agreements that goes on among policy-related economists, which is, well, we know that because of the gains from trade, we can make society better off and no one worse off, so we have to do this. But in fact, many trade agreements can make a few people a lot better off and a heck of a lot of people worse off. So there's something quite disingenuous by pretending that we have to go forward with this policy because hypothetically you could make everyone better off when there is zero probability it will ever happen.
And isn't another piece of that, not just that it's hypothetical, but when you aggregate and you say, will it improve, you know, this number or that number for the whole country, you may get a yes. But the benefits of that improvement go to very few, and the harms of that aggregate plus is actually that the negative goes to many, many more. Isn't that what it is, partly?
Well, that's a possibility. I mean, there are a whole lot of people who talk about flyover America, that New York and San Francisco are doing fine, and everybody else in between, whether as victims of smarter machines and automation or trade agreements, which financiers benefit a great deal from with their access to what I'll call capital mobility. In other words, they can invest all over the world. Multinational corporations can put their technology, their expertise, and their plants in China or other places that have weak environmental and labor standards and make more profits, and the stockholders make more profits. And but the workforce is challenged.
That used to do that work in the U.S. is challenged. What I meant was that they can point to numbers that say, see, it's good for America. But those numbers are are actually, if you then look at, well, let's see, how much of America is it good for and how much of America does it hurt, that the numbers are so out of whack, the benefits to the few are so high that if you look at the whole number, oh, it looks great. Is that, I mean, that's kind of what goes on, right?
Well, yeah. In other words, the averages mask what's happening to most people.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, that kind of thing does transpire. You know, people will change the statistics they look at. Like, they'll look at the median income as opposed to the average income and so forth to try to mitigate some of that. And by the way, the statistics, which are kind of hiding in plain sight, where people like the Economic Policy Institute in Washington and others produce, have been showing inequality rising and accelerating since the late 1970s. And really, it's only after Occupy Wall Street and others with the 99%, 1% mantra that they were chanting that people in, and even leaders in the press have started to take this seriously. And now you have Tom Piketty, Joe Stiglitz, and others writing, you know, very, very penetrating books on this, on the question. But our politics, particularly given the role of money in politics, has not taken globalization and technical change and mitigated the adjustment and what you might call created a leveling. It's actually exacerbated the inequality by all of the cuts and benefits to most of the working class, compression of the public school systems, deterioration of infrastructure, and then massive tax cuts for the most wealthy in the United States.
And are you aware also, just when people want to look at the effects of this inequality, you're aware of the book The Spirit Level?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
They were actually at my first conference.
Oh, there you go. And let me see if I've...
Wilkinson and Pickett, I believe.
Wilkinson and Pickett.
Those are the two authors, and they have a website called The Equality Trust, which I think everybody should have a look at.
Absolutely. So they were guests on my show. And for those who haven't heard of this book, this is an interesting case. What they are is they're actually epidemiologists.
Yes.
And they went and they looked at many, many countries for 30 years. I mean, most countries, I think most developed economies for 30 years. And they looked at the effects. And what they found was that the more unequal the distribution of income and wealth in a country, the worse off for everyone. That the well-off also, the well-off of a country that has a lot of equality, like the Scandinavian countries, do better than the well-off in a country like the U.S. where inequality runs amok. And so it's not just the poor who do better when there's more equality. Everyone does more.
There's a wonderful example of this in the United States in a film. The director Mark Levin has created a film about education in New York City called Class Divide. And right across the street from the projects is a private school, a $40,000 to $50,000 a year tuition private school called the Avenue School. And Mark very sensitively interviews people, we'll call it, on both sides of the tracks, and finds that the psychic harm to the students in those high tuition schools who are fortunate because their parents have wealth or their grandparents have wealth or whatever is very, very damaging to their self-image. They're feeling like they're participating in a meritocracy or just being able to explain it to the kids when they're outside playing basketball. And it's a beautiful film. It's I believe it's on HBO. I think you can find it online. And but it's almost like a story for our age.
Yeah.
About
yeah.
a lot of things illustrated by these really, really articulate and sensitive children describing their own sensibilities about the world they're growing up in.
Wonderful. Class Divide.
Mark said, our generation, Mark and I are approximately the same age. He said our generation was about the civil rights movement and about the anti-war movement. He said inequality is the movement for this generation. And restoring a balance to our politics.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Rob Johnson. He's the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. He's director of the Project in Global Finance at the Roosevelt Institute. And you can learn more about his work at ineteconomics.org. I mean, I-N-E-T, Institute for New Economic Thinking. So ineteconomics.org. You can also learn more about this show. You'll be able to find this podcast and many, many others at my website, terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. Okay, I want to read to you something that I came across in preparing for this interview. This was an exchange we had in August 2011. So again, we're going back to about the time that you, a little after you started the Institute, 6 years ago, much closer to the crash, 5 years before the election of Trump. So let me read this and then please respond. And clearly everything we've been talking about so far, if someone reads between the lines, lays the groundwork for Trump's election. This is what I said in 2011. I'm disappointed in how we're doing as a nation and a global society. I expected us to be more serious, perhaps, about the challenges we face, about what a successful society offers and asks of us, about the responsibility that comes with our enormous wealth, power, and influence, about our responsibility to our children in the future. I believe that ever since television advertising became the dominant activity of campaigns, politics has more and more come to be owned by the super rich and the biggest corporations, especially finance. Politics, in return, works for them, building a system that meets their desires, a self-perpetuating vicious circle. The political and economic system that results is not delivering. It's not meeting the needs of a 21st century society in terms of health, education, work, or treatment of our children, seniors, and nature. We are not investing sufficiently in our future or the future of the planet. We're wasting time, money, attention, energy, and ultimately the lives of millions. I know in the midst of this, great advances are made in all sorts of arenas, but the big picture looks very challenging. At this point back then, I asked if you shared my perspective. Nothing's changed unless it's gotten worse.
Well, my view, I'll quote my friend Gillian Tett, who runs the New York office of the Financial Times. She's trained as a cultural anthropologist, and she said, Rob, study what doesn't happen and study the silences, because that map reveals the contours of power in society. And I think what we've seen, which is quite sad, is this set of silences was unmasked by Donald Trump's campaign and by Bernie Sanders' campaign.
Yep.
And they both pointed out the system being rigged, the role of money in politics, et cetera. And unfortunately, both the 17 or 16 candidates that Donald Trump beat and the Democrats that he ultimately beat were people who were accustomed to playing what I will call the inside game of politics. And they abided by a lot of silences. People accuse the Democratic Party of trying to create a coalition, what I'll call cultural coalition, related to gender and race and other things, without addressing economics. Famous philosopher Richard Rorty wrote a book, Achieving Our Country, which the New York Times cited before the election.
About the neglect of economics. And when did he write that? Because it was
in the 1990s.
Yeah, but it was a harbinger, or you know,
Christopher Lash's book, The Revolt of the Elites, written at the end of the 80s, which, for better or for worse, people say Steve Bannon considers one of his five top books to describe what he saw in the United States. But you see, essentially, the major parties, I mentioned the 16 or 17 candidates on the Republican side and the Clintons on the Democratic side, are busy doing fundraisers, private equity corporations, hedge funds, Hollywood stars, and so forth. And there are certain things that just aren't discussed or aren't addressed in the economic sphere, because they probably don't want to chase away the fundraisers.
Right, and
adopt a cultural agenda to try to energize people and activate their participation on reproductive rights and other dimensions, criminal justice system. All those things are important, but we got got to a place where, I'll quote the song of Jack White and Meg White, the White Stripes, called Effect and Cause. And the second verse says, I ain't the reason, you gave me no reason to return your call. You built a house of cards and you shocked, you know, you seen it fall. I ain't innocent, in fact the reverse. But when you go into the grave, you don't blame the hearse. You're like a little girl screaming when you at your brother when you lost his ball. And I think these fault lines that produced Donald Trump's election, produced these reactions, have been hiding in plain sight and growing, whether it's the financial crisis, trade agreements, neglect of the environment, neglect of the social instability associated with inequality. And it's just been building and building and building since that time in 2011 we spoke. Yeah. And at this point, the population is not tolerating it. On the other hand, I don't see President Trump now stepping up to take on the rigged system or the challenges in the way that his campaign appeared to promise.
Right.
And I'm fearful that the despair will come even more deep now, because the people who were despairing that leapt onto his bandwagon now have nowhere to run, nowhere to hide.
I hear what you're saying. The fact that he hasn't delivered means their desperation and distrust now just can be broader.
Yeah, it can be, but you have to be a little bit careful there, because until somebody offers a vibrant alternative, their reaction may be cognitive dissonance, which is, I don't want to admit I got duped, because I'm now even more despairing. I'm not going to take it on. I'm not going to address it, because it's getting worse. It's getting more scary. It's getting more dire.
Yeah.
And I think one of the saddest events of 2017 was when the health care bill failed. Everybody across the spectrum in the Democratic Party should have stood up and said, single payer, Medicare for all. That's
Absolutely.
Start providing a magnet that's an alternative that isn't pandering to the pharmaceutical insurance or hospitalization industries, and the American people would react to that.
Well, at that moment when their attention was on it, at their moment when there was, you know, we want something different, that was the moment. Now, Bernie Sanders did immediately.
Yes, he did.
Right, sponsor a bill that says that, but it wasn't the entire party. It wasn't.
Let's be a little bit fair. I don't think these people are kamikazes. They're not suicidal. Money in politics still matters a lot. And there are a lot of Democrats who would like to do the right thing, who differ with Bernie in the sense that if we just walk away from the industry after finance, meaning medical industrial complex, the second source, biggest source of fundraising in money in politics, where are we going to go? Where are we going to get ourselves up there and pay for these campaigns? The rules of money in politics, the rules that you and I talked about with advertising costs, are still there. Now, maybe, I don't know, maybe Bernie's online activism and the retail sources of funding showed a new way of approaching this.
Those average $27 contributions.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump, because of his high net worth, is a different trajectory. Michael Bloomberg can pursue that trajectory, but not a lot of candidates can. But I think we're in a place where maybe Bernie's approach has promise. But I'm disappointed, but I'm understanding that in a system that depends on so much money and you have such concentrated wealth, I can understand the reluctance of people to do good policy. You know, you probably heard of this paper or even had them on your show, Benjamin Page and Martin Gillens,
right?
Does surveys on what do people want in the top 1%, what do people want in, you know, say the 70% starting at the bottom. And what the legislature produces in America, unsurprisingly in the era of money and politics, is almost always what the 1% wants and neglects most of what the 70% want when they're at odds with the 1%. And that's the kind of stuff that produced Donald Trump. I don't think prior to Inauguration Day, Donald Trump was a cause of anything. He was the effect of dysfunction. He becomes a cause, obviously, as he becomes the president and responsible for policy. But this was a pretty darn deep ditch and dire situation.
Yeah, and one thing,
to his showing up.
When you were describing the 16 other Republican candidates and the Clintons, let me add two things. Basically, what you're saying is all the candidates who could not draw crowds of 25,000 people. In other words, there were two candidates who could, and that was Sanders and Trump. And you know, that to me, if you're talking about either what the people care about or who's going to turn out on election day, that's the meter. And the second thing is, you said certain things cannot be talked about by those inside gamers, and you said economics, but it also is politics. Bernie would lead, when I saw him at least, would lead almost every speech with the corruption of the political system and the need for change and public financing and so on. And that's the other thing they won't talk about.
That's right, because at some level, when you're reliant on the money, and it gives you an edge, say if you're an incumbent, you can sell policy, build a war chest, and deter quality people from running against you, a lot are reluctant to give up that advantage. But I think Bernie's challenge is interesting. I'm a little bit sad that the Democratic Party isn't exploring that pathway more. But I do hear sophisticated Democrats say to me, okay, now Trump is acting like an oligarch for the plutocrats and that whole crowd. What happens if we go Bernie's populist route? All the money shifts and backs Trump for reelection. And politicians who haven't raised money have been trampled over the last 25, 30 years. So this is a structural problem that I wish was resolved so that people like Bernie could win. But I understand that there are a lot of people who don't think it's been resolved, and they think it's foolhardy to, how would I say, pretend that we have a democracy when what we have is a plutonomy.
Right, and so the experiment of saying we're going to depend on the smaller contributions is a very high-risk game, as you say. Mm-hmm. In other words, Trump said, I'm going to drain the swamp and I'm going to be for the little man. His policies, however, are, I mean, as we know, more Goldman Sachs folks, more millionaires, more billionaires than have ever been in an administration. His policies are exactly what the 1% want. And so, as you say, yeah, you take that experiment, he gets, instead of 50% of that money, he gets all of it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, think about it. Let's think about it a different way. Because we've been talking about the Democratic Party's non-reaction in the healthcare debate. You've got control of both houses and the White House in the Republican Party right now. You have an aggrieved public that stood up for Trump. If the Republicans were to create single payer for all, an infrastructure plan, and a more vibrant economy and wages go up, they could stand and look at the American people and said, we just had like a mini New Deal. You don't need another Democrat for 50 years. And they can't pull it off.
Yeah.
Because they're hamstrung by money politics within their own coalition. And a lot of the guys in the House of Representatives benefit from the gerrymandering, but they still need a lot of money, and the people in the Senate even more. They can't even design a policy matrix that's really responsive to the people who put them in power. And those contradictions will become apparent. It's a failing that comes from the same sources that I think are inhibiting the Democrats. I think the system is structurally poorly designed and unrepresentative. It's not just stupidity.
So it can't deliver two things. One, it can't deliver policy and results that benefit the American people, and two, it can't deliver representative democracy.
Right. I think, unfortunately, that's correct on both counts.
Where do we go from here? In other words, you've got an institute that's for new economic thinking.
Yep.
We need more. It turns out we need new thinking across the board. Where do you think we go from here?
Okay. First of all, I think the focus on political economy I do things on finance theory or environmental science or whatever, and all of that is about the agenda of changing the intellectual world. But in terms of making change in our society that reinvigorates the confidence of the body politic in the system and the results, I think we have to focus on voter suppression, registration and turnout, and removing money from politics. I think until removing or greatly diminishing money from politics, you would always be facing this, what you might call skewing of policy towards the top. But I am very concerned. I'm very interested in watching, for instance, the work of Reverend William Barber and the Moral Mondays group in North Carolina. He has been very successful in creating what I call a fusion politics between black and white in lower middle class and lower class groupings to fight for the basic infrastructure in state and local regions. He's also been very successful in overturning voter suppression. Some of the highlights of people who lost, including the governor in North Carolina, and then tried to hamstring the person who won, was the direct result of Barber's winning in some voter suppression lawsuits, he and others that he worked with. But this question, I believe, played a big role in who didn't turn out in Wisconsin and various other places in what you might call key swing states in the Electoral College. And no one can pretend we have a democracy with widespread voter suppression. That's another way of deadening the system's responsiveness to people. So I think that's a very important frontier.
Yeah, I can remember. I think it was in after the 2000 election. God, it's that I started talking about what we need is a restored democracy trifecta, which is media reform, voting reform, and campaign reform. And and you're basically saying here, 17 years later, voter reform and financing reform is and as I say, Bernie, for whatever else he was talking about, single payer, you name it, he led off every speech that I saw with that as his lead issue.
Yeah, there's someone who I can't remember who made a documentary called "Requiem for the American Dream," where Noam Chomsky was interviewed about all of the conditions that are necessary to stop democracy from working right. And I know he's been on Amy Goodman's show recently and articulated this, and there's apparently a companion volume that's coming out with the film. That, you know, his perspective is that this is a systematic attempt by wealth and power to short-circuit democracy. I think it bears scrutinizing some of what he and others are saying about the structure of what impedes representativeness and responsiveness of the system.
Yeah. But let me just ask you, I've been saying those were the primary issues to restore democracy. In other words, policy, that can happen however it is, but its only chance of being actually representative of the people or even the majority is these steps to restore democracy.
This is a very treacherous realm. I mean, democracy is what we might call gives legitimacy to our society. A capitalist democracy embeds capitalism in a democratic system and gets its moral legitimacy from being governed by a democracy. But there are an awful lot of people, and you've heard a lot of these voices since Trump was elected, that act like, well, the raging mobs or the uneducated or whatever can't be trusted. The experts have all been refuted, and there's a lot of disappointment, which just underneath the surface is a profound refutation of the value of democracy. And there are a lot of people lurking back around the Weimar Republic, looking at Italy and Germany in the 30s. A book I recommend everybody read right now is the management theorist Peter Drucker's very first book. It was called The End of Economic Man, and it's about the disintegration of order in Germany and Austria in the 1930s. And it's really about losing faith in any kind of structure or idea. But he does not paint a portrait of democracy working well in a period of heightened anxiety and fear. In other words, a traumatized body politic does not necessarily, we might call, drive towards healthy democratic proposals in the first instance. And, of course, a lot of people think that's what brought Trump to power. So I think this is fascinating terrain. You know, I'm in the business of challenging everything and challenging the idea that markets are divine and do everything right is at the center of my business. But challenging the idea that government fixes it the right way and isn't corrupt is something that comes from the right towards the left, and you got to take that into account. But the very nature and functioning of democracy needs to be studied, not become an article of faith that at times can disappoint you as well.
Right. And also, as we've seen, and I think one thing that'll be interesting to watch, actually, is that this resistance, this re-energized populace that is marching and going to town halls and making calls like they probably haven't, perhaps ever, echoing in some ways the Tea Party from the early Obama years. If that lasts, and if that lasts, what that means. Because America has been, for years, basically an election-only democracy, right? In other words, engagement, most people had no time and didn't think about it, and you show up to vote every now and then. Well, then everything else we've talked about of television advertising, the cost of television advertising, who people raise money from, so who they work for, et cetera. When all you focus on is elections, you have given the game away. But if we haven't energized a populace, then perhaps things can change. Let me ask you one last question that I'll give you about 3 minutes to answer. And if it's too out there, just say, next question. If you could look back from 2040 or so, did the U.S. turn things around? And if they did, how did that happen?
If the U.S. is to turn things around between now and 2040, it has to bring its medical services under the same kind of cost discipline that most of the other advanced nations do. They pay about half what the American does per capita. And most of those countries have, by the World Health Organization measures, higher quality medical care.
Right. We rank 37 according to that.
So now, we're 37th. You're exactly right. And so let's have all our budget hawks, all the people that tromp around self-righteously and talk about deficits all the time, focus on what the problem is. And the medical industrial complex excesses compared to proven examples around the world has to be taken on for 2040 to be a better time and place. The second dimension is, I think, the degree of the United States military industrial complex has to be diminished. It's a smaller percentage of GDP now than it was because the economy has grown so much and people have substituted capital for armies and so forth. In other words, technology, drones replaced armies and things like that. But the fact of the matter is, I feel like until your public schools and your health and your infrastructure and your retirement security is taken care of, the idea that all of these, we're not playing defense, we're playing offense with our military. And I think that's got to be curtailed, and I don't know how in a fear-based climate you bring that off. And then the third dimension, as we've talked about at length in this conversation, is you've got to make the society responsive to something other than highly concentrated wealth, whether it's in a form of organizations like corporations or banks, or it's in the form of very, very high net worth individuals.
Well, any thoughts, Rob, about this is where you're almost putting on your science fiction hat, but, you know, when you're thinking new economic thinking in a way, you're putting on your science fiction hat. Mm-hmm. How those shifts could happen?
Well, right now, I think people are quite unhappy with the medical system. They see Obamacare as kind of half a loaf and too expensive. If I was a small businessman, I just, you know, I look at the foundation I run and the health care bills there. It's easy to be resentful and bringing to bear more and more pressure from a broad base of society to get that right. Some politician may figure out that if he takes on pharma and insurance and scores a goal, he could be heroic and be reelected for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think the American people would breathe an enormous sigh of relief and celebrate any president that could overcome that challenge.
Yeah,
I think Obama tried.
Yeah,
I think he was he was getting the best he could.
Yeah,
particularly for a lot of uninsured people. But it was a first step in something that needs to evolve.
Yeah. No, but I hear what you're saying. Is it actually that one? And in some ways, and we got to draw this to a close, but in some ways, Trump's election and what that says about how broken the game is,
yes,
makes it a little more likely that this out of the norm on the other side could happen and take off, I think.
My hope would be, this is science fiction, is that the people who are wealthy and powerful in America, some of whom I'm quoted from an old Davos lecture, are buying airstrips and land in New Zealand. In other words, an escape hatch.
Oh, absolutely.
As an insurance policy. But if the notion of stewardship among the wealthy and powerful with a broad base mindset like we had after World War II, though it didn't apply as much to women and people of color at that time, so I want to be careful.
Yeah.
But Social Security, in other words, retirement security, health security, education, rebuilding the nation. These are kind of words that Donald Trump said.
Yep.
Stewardship, where they pay their, what you might call insurance premium, to invigorating and fortifying our domestic well-being rather than building escape hatches. I think there are some very good-minded, affluent people. Most of them, though, to be fair, feel powerless. They know how to escape with their money. They know how to protect their corporation. But they don't know how to enact constructive system-wide change. You know, when I talk to people about, would you be willing to have your taxes raised? Many of them say, yeah, but not for bank bailouts to support the medical industrial complex and the military adventures. And I'm sympathetic with that. I don't want to pay more money to support all of those.
Exactly, yeah.
Parts of the rigged system. But affluent people need to be part of this coalition of a vision of what makes this place healthy. And I will say this. The election of Donald Trump has scared more affluent people than any other thing I've seen in my adult life.
So
they realize he's a symptom. He's an effect. And there are a lot of people very concerned in both parties.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, that
so maybe
I, yeah.
Maybe that impetus, maybe that awareness, that wonderful experiment called the United States of America is at risk. You don't want to get to the place where, when you cite our founding documents, somebody thinks you're a romantic fool. You want them to believe in those principles, and when we behave at odds with those principles, that tension of that distance becomes part of the what you might call energy or catalyst to a restoration of getting us back on track. And I think we're dangerously close right now to being called romantic fools by appealing to those principles.
Thank you very much, Rob Johnson. Keep up the
My
good
pleasure.
Work. Okay, this was great. So again, the website is netEconomics.org, INET, Institute for New Economic Thinking, Economics, netEconomics.org. And for this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to TerrenceMcNally.net. That's TerrenceE McNally.net, or A World That Just Might Work. aworldthatjustmightwork.com, the same website. If you want to receive a weekly email telling you about upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the free forum podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site, terrencemcnally.net, or at iTunes. Listen anytime, anywhere. Archives include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, etc. Thanks to Kiana, my engineer, George Vassilopoulos, Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. See you soon.